All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Amanda L. Meredith presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and its Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Judge Meredith. To my right is Judge Falvey, and to my left is Judge Jaquith. We are convened today to consider arguments in the matter of James Martin Witkowski, versus Douglas Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 24640. Will counsel, starting with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
April Donahauer of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick for the appellant, Mr. Witkowski. With me at counsel table is Jenna Zellmer, also of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick.
Thank you.
Emily Stanley for the secretary, joined by Mark Hamill.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes, please.
Okay, we'll make that happen. And if you are ready to please. Proceed, please begin.
May it please the court. Well before the board invoked Bowling v. Principe to deny benefits in this case, the secretary and several members of this court agreed that Bowling is wrong. It is time to overrule that case. And because Bowling is clearly irreconcilable with intervening Supreme Court precedent, a panel of this court can overrule it without convening the full court. Also, Bowling is contrary to the plain language of Section 4.16b. Alternatively, the court should hold that the board can waive the referral requirement in Section 4.16b. Whether the court overrules Bowling or holds that waiver is available, the board erred in this case in refusing to adjudicate the merits of Mr. Witkowski's entitlement to TDIU, and the court should vacate and remand for it to do so. I welcome the court's questions.
So I would start with, in your brief, you argued that Bowling gave jurisdictional significance to 4.16b's referral requirement. And I acknowledge that in Bowling it has the words that the board has no power to adjudicate extra schedule or TDIU in the first instance. But does power necessarily equate to jurisdiction? And as an example, I'd say Section 7252, which is our jurisdictional statute, says that the court has jurisdiction to review board decisions, but then it says we have the power to affirm or reverse or modify them. So are those two terms necessarily synonymous?
Here, I think they are, Your Honor, because it strips a class of cases out of the board's ability to hear in the first instance. And I think that that has jurisdictional significance. I do recognize that there has been some discussion over the distinction between first instance board ability to look at 4.16b and eventual ability to look at 4.16b. But even if that is true, it still takes that whole class of cases out of the board's ability to hear. And even if the court were to disagree with that point in the legacy system, it certainly has jurisdictional significance in AMA cases such as this one, because once the board remands for referral, as is currently required under Bowling, that essentially exhausts that NOD. The board has adjudicated the NOD by taking the case and sending it back under 4.16b, and under 20.800 and 20.802, that NOD is no longer live. After referral, the case goes to the AOJ to implement whatever the director decides, and it will not return to the board unless a new NOD is filed.
So getting back to was it a jurisdictional holding in Bowling is what I was getting at. And assuming it wasn't, assuming Bowling didn't mean no jurisdiction when they said power, is it possible Bowling has still been undermined by subsequent Supreme Court case law? Because to the extent it was talking about a claims processing rule by saying the board has no power, does that leave room for exceptions, which we now know if it's a claims processing rule, there are exceptions for waiver or forfeiture. Is it maybe still inconsistent with Supreme Court case law because it was too categorical in saying that there's no power?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I mean, alternatively, as we argued, Bowling didn't get into the notion of waiver, but it certainly seems to suggest that it is a categorical rule. And if the case has not yet been referred, the board must refer it. And that has been overruled by the line of cases most fulsomely discussed in Hall about the board's ability to hear all issues in the matter before it. And the inability of a regulation to narrow that power.
So as to that issue of waiver and forfeiture, in order to waive or forfeit, a party has to have a right and either relinquish it unintentionally or not raise it timely. Who has the right under 4.156B to referral? Is this a benefit for VA that they would then have to waive or forfeit, or is it a benefit to the appellant that would have to waive or forfeit it, or is it maybe a combination of both?
We don't really see it as providing any right or benefit to the claimant. Here, I think it's more analogous to a claim processing step, like the one at issue in Bolds, or like the one at issue in Hall, or the one at issue in Barrel v. Brown from many years ago now about the VA-9 requirement. So calling it a right is when it runs to the secretary, it's more of a rule than a right, as it would be like the right to a hearing, for example, for the claimant. So as we explained in the brief, it was really a request. Mr. Witkowski made a request to the agency to waive compliance with that claim processing rule.
So as to who benefits from 4.116B, in wages, the court talked about that there may be reasons that VA would want to have referral, that maybe controlling the uniformity of extra schedule awards or controlling or gathering in one place the information about when those are necessary. So here the board purported to accept the appellant's waiver to whatever extent they have a right to direct a referral. Do we need, if we were to remand, could we direct the board to adjudicate extra schedule TDIU, or do we need to know if VA has waived whatever rights they have under B for director referral?
I think the short answer is yes, the court can direct the board to adjudicate on the merits. And there are essentially three off-ramps in this case. So two involve overruling Bowling, one of which, because it's essentially already been overruled by the Supreme Court case law, and so it would simply be to acknowledge that. Another off-ramp is to rule that Bowling misinterpreted Section 4.16B because the board is not a rating board. And your question, Your Honor's question, gets at the third off-ramp, I think, which is the waiver issue. The board addressed the request unmistakably to waive this requirement. And I don't think there's any need for a remand for the board to get a second bite at that apple, because it said, it purported to honor the request, but then said we have to deny because we're doing that. And the only reason for that being that it saw Bowling as requiring it to either refer or deny the claim. So I think the court can say that was a legally incorrect reason, and the board needs to adjudicate on the merits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have another question about the waiver requirement, the off ramp, if you will. Can we use that to get If, without overturning Bowling, is it can anyone waive Bowling essentially?
So that Your Honor gets at who's doing the waiving, and it's our view. I think Bolds helped to clarify this, that because 4.16b contains a claim processing rule, it's the secretary that is that the waiver ability runs to. So certainly any claimant can ask for waiver.
But if Bowling stands for the proposition that the board has no power, wouldn't the board then saying, I'm going to entertain a waiver here, subvert our holding in Bowling?
I think as Judge...
In other words, don't you have to get to the question of whether Bowling should be overturned or not? Because you're kind of doing it kind of backdoor. You're kind of saying, well, you can waive it because it doesn't really stand for what it says it stands for. To me, that's overruling it.
We certainly have no problem with taking that path, Your Honor. I see the tension there. But Bowling didn't expressly address waiver. So I think there's a world in which the court could look at Bowling and say, in a legacy case at least, it's a first instance determination. I think Judge Steinberg's dissent in Floyd nicely discusses the first instance, which he saw as still encroaching on the board's jurisdiction. But certainly, I think in an AMA case, Bowling is wrong insofar as it says that these cases are outside the board's jurisdiction. So the preferable course here would be to say that for one or the other reason that I mentioned, that Bowling is no longer good law.
So on the clearly irreconcilable one, what's our test or our standard or definition of what is clearly irreconcilable? Rory doesn't give us much. Is just the plain language clearly irreconcilable, and we try to find out whether it's, if we can think of a way it's reconcilable, then it's not clearly, or what do we do with that?
I think the question is whether that intervening Supreme Court case law has so undermined the express or implicit theory or reasoning of the case that it can no longer be fairly said to stand. And that's the case here insofar as Bowling said that the board simply can't look at this category of cases in the first instance because of what a regulation says. We know now from the Supreme Court case law that a regulation simply cannot have that sort of jurisdictional significance. I think that it is certainly a high bar, but as judge after judge on this court has recognized pretty much since Bowling was decided, and increasingly so since we've gotten this case law from the Supreme Court, which dates to 2006, 2007 at the latest, where we started to get this line of cases about regulations not being able to strip adjudicatory jurisdiction from an agency tribunal. It's been clearly reconcilable.
Do you see a, and if it's not, then this panel, and we assume the waiver argument doesn't fly with a majority of the panel. We need to go en banc. Would that be true?
If you disagreed both with clearly irreconcilable and waiver?
Right. To get to the question, is Bowling wrong, or is the, what is the correct, proper interpretation of 4.16b?
I think
the board is not a rating board.
Right. I think that is to say that Bowling was wrong from the outset, and that I believe would require a full court decision. But I don't.
No other escape hatch. Or off ramp.
Other than waiver and clearly irreconcilable, I think those are, unless I mean, if the court agrees with Bowling's interpretation of the regulation, then I suppose the regulation could be held invalid because it improperly constrains the board's statutory jurisdiction under 7104A. And I do recognize the clearly irreconcilable standard is a high bar, but because of the growing consensus over time of members of this court in light of this case law, I do think that that bar is surpassed here.
In the analysis of whether stare decisis would prevent the court from overturning Bowling, whether it's this panel or en banc, would the fact that the Bowling was wrong from the get-go weigh into that analysis?
Absolutely. That's one of the factors. It's one that the court discussed in Raven, along with clearly irreconcilable. There's the quality of the reasoning from the outset. I think, you know, the Floyd dissent sort of anticipated the flaws in the reasoning of Bowling. It doesn't get into a full analysis of the text of the regulation. It doesn't get into an analysis of the interrelationship between the regulation and the statutory scheme. So that is a factor. But although that is part of the stare decisis analysis, I think if the court were to agree on the clearly irreconcilable piece of that analysis alone, then again, it's essentially acknowledging that Bowling already is not good law, and so it would simply be to acknowledge that that the Supreme Court precedent has shown it to be such.
If we were to go down that clearly irreconcilable path, would we have to discuss stare decisis at all, or would it be helpful to discuss it to work out the clearly irreconcilable standard?
I think so, based on the discussion in Rory, which talked about, you know, stare decisis is of course a very serious consideration, and the clearly irreconcilable standard developed to reconcile the concerns underpinning stare decisis, stability in the law, and so forth, and the reality that the law as developed by higher controlling tribunals changes over time and may fatally erode the reasoning of earlier cases.
My last question, the in that stare decisis analysis, I think there's something about unworkability.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your point about this referral process, it's maybe workable, but it's workable in a derogatory manner to veterans, in the sense that it adds additional unnecessary steps and time?
Yes to that, and also it's unworkable as shown by the case law that has sprung up around we have to create different standards at the referral stage and at the merit stage, because otherwise the director's decision is just a rubber stamp. And those cases followed from the prior cases where there was debate over is the board bound by the director's decision. So we had sort of the Anderson, Kupamala wages phase. And I think those were all in some way or another about trying to make this unworkable system seem legitimate.
I said it was my last question, so I'll see.
How are we to regard the Federal Circuit's holding in Thun, that's how you say it, that seems to endorse the regulation's division of labor between the board and regional offices authority to determine that a veteran is eligible for extra scheduler consideration, but only the director of compensation services or the undersecretary can actually give the rating?
I think this court already did so in Snyder, Your Honor, where it addressed Thun in a significant portion of the decision and noted that the Federal Circuit's decision in Thun, when it talked about 4.16b by analogy to 3.321, it was Snyder noted that the Federal Circuit limited its discussion to the AOJ, and Snyder said pretty clearly that that Thun is just about what the regulation says about RO power.
What if the board had acknowledged its power to give extra scheduler consideration to the TDIU claim, but decided to follow VA policy and send it back in the face of the veterans waiver?
I still think that would have been error, Your Honor. I mean, maybe it would have been by another name, but it still essentially would have been to follow Bowling. There is this provision in 20.802A that permits the board to remand cases for correction of a procedural defect. But the important caveat there is, my time is about to expire. May I finish? Thank you. The important caveat in 20.802A is there has to be a reasonable possibility of substantiating the claim, and there just wouldn't be here, because the only thing it would be going back for the director to do is something that the board itself can do. So there's nothing added there by the director making a duplicative decision. Thank you.
May proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. The board followed the law when it explained why it could not adjudicate entitlement to extra scheduler TDIU in the first instance after appellant explicitly waived his right to director referral. In Bowling versus Principi, this court held that the board has no power to adjudicate extra scheduler TDIU in the first instance. And even when appellant waived referral, the board had no authority to adjudicate the claim without first referring it to the director. Nevertheless, the secretary agrees with the appellant that the court should reconsider its holding in Bowling. Although we do not agree that Bowling is clearly irreconcilable with intervening Supreme Court precedent, we agree that en banc review is warranted for the court to reconsider Bowling because it is inconsistent with the plain language of 38 CFR 4.16b, and because it results in unnecessary delay for veterans. Although we ask the court to overturn Bowling, the high standard is not met for the court to find that it was clearly irreconcilable with the intervening Supreme Court precedent. In those cases, they involved claim processing rules that were treated as complete bars to jurisdiction. Here, under the Bowling scheme, the board retains jurisdiction to decide whether or not referral is warranted. And then after it's referred to the director and the director makes a decision, the board then has ultimate authority over that decision. So it's not a complete bar to jurisdiction.
Isn't it a complete bar to jurisdiction in the first instance?
It is, Your Honor. It is a complete bar to adjudicating in the first instance, yes. Under Hammer versus Neighborhood Housing Services, which is one of the cases that appellant relied on, the lower court dismissed a claim because it found that it lacked jurisdiction based on a time limit. And the Supreme Court found that that was a claim processing rule, not a jurisdictional rule. And in Union Pacific Railroad, the Railroad Board found that it didn't have jurisdiction because the parties didn't engage in the required conferencing and the party that wanted to assert that right waited too long to assert that right. So the Supreme Court found that that was a claim processing rule that could be forfeited. So both of these cases involved a right that wasn't asserted in time, and it was found to be forfeited or waived. These are distinguishable from our case because here the board does not fully lose jurisdiction. It does have the power to decide whether or not referral is warranted. It does have ultimate authority. And it's not like those cases where a claim completely stops due to a lack of jurisdiction. It's more like a situation where it's not ripe for the board's review, and it needs an additional step before the board is able.
Ms. Donahoe's point that, at least in the AMA, you have to start over again. I mean,
yes, Your Honor. The AMA does complicate things, and it does change things a bit, for sure. However, the board does still have some jurisdiction over the claim. It still decides whether or not referral is appropriate, and it still will have ultimate authority over the decision. So we agree that these cases do raise questions about the tenability of the holding in Bowling, but we just don't think that clearly irreconcilable is standard is met. So
what flesh that clearly irreconcilable out for me. What does that mean?
So as appellant's counsel said, it's basically when the reasoning or theory underpinning a case is so inconsistent with
check. Right? Bowling's wrong, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree that Bowling's
wrong. You agree, as we agree, and we've checked that box.
I agree that Bowling is incorrect and should be reevaluated. So if this court...
What else? It's irreconcilable. We've got that. It's got to be more than that. It's a high bar, right?
Yes, yes. Well, so if this court, say, just as an example, in Bowling had specifically used the word jurisdiction and said the board does not have jurisdiction to adjudicate this.
No power. It's not enough.
I think it definitely raises the question of jurisdiction, Your Honor. But
is it Arbaugh that used that language as well?
Yes, Arbaugh.
Clearly you're talking about jurisdiction there.
Yes, Your Honor. Arbaugh, I believe in Arbaugh they used the word jurisdiction, but I may be mistaken.
I think they talked about in terms of jurisdiction, meaning you had no power.
Yes, Your Honor.
So
I think the language they use here is that the board cannot address this. Isn't that the same thing? And doesn't that mean no jurisdiction?
Your Honor, the board, yes, it could not address it in the first instance. It could address whether or not the claim should be referred. And it could, once the director who that power to adjudicate in the first instance had been found to be delegated to, once they addressed it, the board could address it. But yes, you're correct. The board could not address it in the first instance because of Bowling. And so we agree that these cases raise issues. We agree that, like in Judge Toth's dissent to the denial of our motion in Snyder, so that was joined by two other judges, two of you, I believe, and the rest of the court, of course, denied en banc consideration at that time. But what Judge Toth said was, I question whether Floyd's prohibition against the board hearing matters in the first instance remains tenable in light of two decades of case law from the Supreme Court clarifying the subtle but important distinction between jurisdictional rules passed by Congress and non-jurisdictional requirements. So while Judge Toth agreed at that time that en banc review was warranted and that those cases were one reason to reconsider Bowling, there wasn't a suggestion at that time that they were met the standard for clearly irreconcilable. If I can go back to a situation where this might look like clearly irreconcilable in the context of our case. So if the board, if the court had used the word jurisdiction in Bowling, and if it were clear that this were a matter that the board could never address in any instance, including, not only in the first instance, but including later, then we would agree that that was clearly irreconcilable. But I just don't think the standard is met in this case.
What about the assertion that the board didn't err because it followed Bowling? Do you quarrel with the rule that our decisions apply retrospectively, especially to the case before us?
No, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify that. We argued that unless and until Bowling is overturned is what we meant. Unless and until Bowling is overturned, then the board did not err. and, you know, followed Bowling. But if this court were...
The secretary is really saying is if the court overturns Bowling, then we would acknowledge that it followed Bowling as it was obliged to do, and that now turns out that that's error.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that you would have to find error, but we agree that that it should be applied to the facts of this case, the holding, if the court decides to overturn Bowling. Yes, we would not argue against that.
You're not questioning the court's authority.
No.
They issued an opinion. You followed it.
Yes. Of course not.
When was this epiphany that Bowling was wrong? It's been 24 years. Why has the regulation not been changed or something to address Bowling? If Bowling's wrong, you don't like it, they don't like it. Why not?
So, Your Honor... Bowling has had critics, as Appellant's counsel pointed out. Honestly, Floyd has had critics since Floyd's inception, and Bowling has had critics since its inception. And we do agree that 4.16b, as written, was never intended to apply to the board. It speaks to rating boards, and we don't believe that the board should be subject to those requirements. So I guess in terms of changing the regulation when you take the plain meaning, as we see it, does not include the board, does not apply to the board. In terms of why we haven't fought harder to overturn Bowling, well, I mean, there's a lot of, there's some, as we were talking about, kind of like the interest that the secretary and the interest that the appellant has in the referral process. There is some benefit to referral for us, as was noted in wages. We use referral to get a sense of how the rating schedule is being applied and to see if there's any changes that need to be made. And so it's not that referral is totally without any benefit. Honestly, just weighing resources and weighing the things that we have, the legal issues that we have to consider, the extra scheduler TDIU, I guess, did not get a ton of our energy to overturn it, basically because it's not a huge burden on us. But our position hasn't changed since Snyder. And since appellant has brought this before the court now, we still agree that Bowling should be overturned.
And it's not that the regulation, there's nothing wrong with the regulation.
No, Your Honor, because I read it.
It's just Bowling's application of that regulation to the board.
Yes, Your Honor.
That should be clarified, overturned.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, this may be your only opportunity. There's not necessarily another oral argument before the en banc court. If this were to go to the en banc court to do what you've asked, this is your one opportunity. So maybe your one opportunity. So I think your argument about the interpretation of 4.16b is pretty clear. What about stare decisis, though? We're going to have to overcome stare decisis standard to overturn. Even the en banc court would have to consider that.
Yes, Your Honor. That's definitely a concern. Stare decisis should be considered. In this case, we agree with the appellant that Bowling has been wrong since its outset and that it's clear that it is inconsistent with the plain language of 4.16b. We also agree with the points about the reasonable possibility standard articulated through Ray and Snyder, that there have been issues with workability. And there's not a great deal of reliance on this rule from the appellant's perspective. It's possible that there's some benefit to referral at the board stage for some appellants. But typically, because the board only refers when it has found that there's a reasonable possibility of unemployability due to service-connected disabilities, it's not it would not be a common situation where an appellant would benefit. It's an unnecessary step.
Would anything prevent the board from referring a case if we were to strike down Bowling?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If
decided that it's a reasonable possibility, I'd like another some more eyes on this.
Maybe, Your Honor. I don't see that happening, but there could be a situation perhaps where the appellant requests it, where that could happen.
And we wouldn't be putting the director out of business, right?
No, Your Honor, because the ROs would still be required.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to follow up on, you acknowledge that there may be some benefit to both VA and to an appellant for 4.16B's referral requirement. So if we were to find that remand is required here, maybe because bullying has been undermined, we know that the board has purportedly accepted the appellant's waiver of whatever rights the appellant has under the referral provision. Would we also need to consider whether VA has waived or forfeited VA's rights under that in order to direct the board to adjudicate extra scheduler?
Your Honor, if you were to find that the board could waive the referral requirement, and we don't believe that under bullying the board could, but if you were to find that, then yes, you would need to consider the board's waiver as well as the claimant's waiver. So in the cases that appellant relies on in Hall and Bolds, those both involved situations where the secretary or the board, so in one case, the secretary signed, wrote and filed a JMR agreeing to waive evidence submission limits. And it was found that that was a waiver on the board's part of those limits. And in Hall, the appellant submitted an incorrect form and the board accepted that form without, processed it without objecting. And that was found to be essentially a waiver. In this case, we don't have the board's actions enacting either a waiver or for forfeiture here. And none of the cases that appellant cites really support the idea that because a claimant requests waiver, the board must grant that waiver.
Okay. I wanted to also follow up on what we were talking about when Bowling's holding about no power to act, and whether that's a jurisdictional holding or claims processing. You're suggesting that it's not clearly irreconcilable with subsequent Supreme Court case law. So can you explain this to us? Because even assuming that Bowling was talking just about a claims processing rule, not about jurisdiction, does no power to act suggest that it's a categorical no, that there's no room for exceptions, and how that wouldn't be irreconcilable with Supreme Court case law saying that if it's a claims processing rule, it is subject to exceptions based on forfeiture or waivers. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, Your Honor. So I agree that it does appear that the board has no power based on the language of bullying. And that does, it does sound like it could have jurisdictional implications, absolutely. We just don't think that it's clearly irreconcilable. Because again, if it were clearly irreconcilable, it would be a situation like all the cases that appellant has cited and that Judge Toll cited in his Snyder dissent, where there was a clear indication, there was no jurisdiction and no ability to address it at any point.
So if we buy into that it's not clearly irreconcilable, does the no power to act, does that leave room for us to say subject to carve out an exception and say subject to waiver or forfeiture? And was Bowling's statement not a categorical no? Is there room there to read into it that they could still be subject to waiver or forfeiture?
Your Honor, I don't believe in Bowling there is room. But if this court were to overturn Bowling, this would be a moot point, of course, because the board would no longer be subject to the referral requirement.
For 24 years now, has VA been treating it as a categorical rule? Has any boards said, well, we know what they said in Bowling, but we think there's a carve out here. We can play in this area.
Your Honor, appellant did point out in his brief some instances of the board. I think that's what you're getting at, of the board doing just that, granting without referral. And we believe that that was incorrect under Bowling. What the board did here was correct. The board is bound by this court's case law, not by other board decisions. But of course, those particular cases were harmless error. And so we would, you know, they wouldn't make it to this court, and we would see no reason to disturb them. But the court here was following the court's case law.
So it's the secretary's view that per bowling, the board could not waive the referral requirement?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would the board have had to say to, in the secretary's view, deny the veterans waiver?
Well, Your Honor, I think the board had to do what it did here, which is explain that under bowling, it is unable to adjudicate in the first instance. If there are no further questions, we ask that the court find that the board correctly follow the law under bowling, and we ask the court to convene en banc to reconsider bowling. Thank you.
Counsel, when you're ready.
In 2006, Arbaugh equated, as Judge Falvey pointed out, I think, that subject matter properly comprehended refers to a tribunal's power to hear a case. So termed as power, termed as jurisdiction, the regulation here as interpreted by bowling impermissibly constrains the board's statutory jurisdiction under 7104. I heard some new arguments about the clearly irreconcilable standard that weren't in the secretary's brief, but I don't think that the specific factual circumstances of the Supreme Court case law really matter to the clearly irreconcilable standard here. I think they're clear in circumstances materially similar that the regulation can't carve out from the mandatory statutory jurisdiction. And the secretary has agreed that the regulation stands as a complete bar to the board's adjudication under 4.16b. In terms of this question of whether there is some benefit from referral, I think Wages tried to justify the existence of this extra claim processing step, but one of the two reasons it came up with just does not apply to the board, because the board already is a centralized adjudicator, so we do not need some duplicative centralized adjudicator keeping an eye on things when we're talking about the board. And also, there's no question of revisiting the rating schedule based on the director's experience with 4.16b cases, because it's a separate path to compensation.
In that vein, is there anything that indicates that the director has special expertise in the matter of extra scheduler TDIU?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Not either in the director's credentials, as far as we could find them, and not in our experience of the contents of the director's decisions on referral. Some recent examples that we would just ask the court to take judicial notice of are really just boilerplate recitations, not a lot of awareness of the facts of the case, some generalized pronouncements about the American work environment that there's no record evidence supporting those pronouncements, and nothing to suggest that the director is qualified to generate evidence on those questions. And then sometimes even the incorrect law is cited in these decisions. So they don't appear to add anything to the process except for delay, burden on the claimant in AMA cases to reappeal a case that the claimant already appealed to the board, and additional expenditure of resources. I would just finally add that Just to clarify what's happening with the waiver question here, it does not have to be accidental, I think, as was suggested. So although Bolds may have involved an inadvertent agreement not to limit the evidentiary window, waiver is something that can be knowing and deliberate, and certainly the board can waive this claim processing rule. And there is no non-arbitrary, capricious, and legally incorrect reason offered here for refusing to waive. So I don't think this needs to go back for the board to have another bite at that apple, because it already answered the question, and the way it did so is not in accordance with law. Just finally, I think I heard a concession that if the court held that Bowling is not good law in this case, it would apply to the case before the court. So I don't think I need to get into the retroactivity question, but I'm certainly happy to answer any questions about that. But if there are none, we would ask for the court to vacate and remand for adjudication on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted, and we will come down and greet counsel.
All right.